welcome to the Inside Myanmar podcast. Before we get into today's show, I want to let you know that we have a lot more written and video content on our website. If you haven't visited it yet, we invite you to take a look at insightmyanmar.org. In addition to complete information about all of our past podcast episodes, there's also a variety of blogs, books, and videos to check out. And we also encourage you to sign up for our monthly newsletter. But for now, enjoy what follows, and remember, sharing is caring. Henning Glaser, thank you so much for taking this time to talk to us here at Insight Myanmar podcast.
Pleasure. Okay, thank you. I am working here at the German Southeast Asian Center of Excellence for Public Policy and Good Governance at Thammasat University. We are an autonomous center. We are founded by German universities, Münster University and Frankfurt University and Thammasat. And our work is dedicated a lot to political affairs, to political order, constitutional things, security affairs. That is basically what we do, both as an academic institute, but also as a think tank.
Mm. So the background of some of the work that you have done, you've touched upon any, well, first we should say you're not just a Myanmar expert, you're the entire Asian region, as you put it to me before this interview, from Afghanistan to Japan, which definitely Myanmar falls into. So there's wider regional issues, but as we look at Myanmar, you have been particularly active on issues such as constitutional reform, federal democracy, on where this conflict is going from, stemming from the transition period to where we are now, and looking at what could happen in a post-military Myanmar. There's any number of topics that we can get to, but I think I'd like to begin by prompting what you said before this interview began, before we started recording, and take that as a launch to start further analysis. Well, we'll get to some of these other subjects. And that's where you shared, you're quite pessimistic with where we're at and where you're looking at things going in Myanmar, in the region, in the global sense, and they're all connected. You're quite pessimistic. So I'd like you to kick off from there.
Okay. It applies to both, to the political outlook of the conflict. I don't see a viable constitution coming out. And before that, the precondition would be that there's a ceasefire, that there's some military solution, and I don't see that either. So that is basically the state of affairs as I see it. We have not a clear dichotomy of good and evil, or not even a dichotomy of clearly delineated forces facing each other. There are so many groups, so many different political visions involved with these groups, that I can't really imagine how could there be a vision, a constitutional vision, to create or to forge a new social contract for Myanmar. That is one point. Simply the groups on the side of the ethnical armed organizations, they are too different. And that is one side. So on the normative side, there is quite some divergence. And also talking about the interests. The interests involved are very, very different. Also the tempo by which these interests can be realized is very different. So different actors might have a different roadmap, or have a different roadmap, and have different gains on the way. And that is why I think, even if there would be, what I don't believe, a military solution in favor of the, let's say, opposition forces, rebel forces, however you call them, I don't see how there could be really a kind of new social contract for a post-war, post-conflict Myanmar, unluckily.
So to push back a little on that and to play devil's advocate, one of the things we have been hearing from a number of actors as well as analysts is this sense that there's never been so much solidarity at any point in Burmese history as we're seeing today. That's on one side. On the other side, the military has never been as weak and as vulnerable as it is today. And so those two things together, while not perfect and while not idealistic or utopian, definitely give a sense. And I would combine with that to have even one more positive element coming in. Gen Z has never been so motivated as they are, and not just motivated in actually picking up guns and fighting, but motivated in every other aspect of what they're doing, much of which goes unreported, and wider Myanmar onlookers, from the CDM movement to the educational and health initiatives they're doing, to the work they're doing of, I've spoken to, as I'm sure you have, so many Burmese that are already envisioning what kind of roadmap and future they could have. So after assuming the military is going to be defeated, so that something like this can't happen again. And so to push back and play devil's advocate, taking in those positive elements notwithstanding, where does your pessimism still overwhelm those potential positivity?
Well, first, I would also agree that you have a remarkable young generation in Myanmar, and of Myanmar people. It's remarkable how they work for their future, how they educate themselves, how they really try to develop solutions, search for patterns they can apply. That's great. But in the end of the day, it's a war, and the parties to that war, they have their agenda, they have their interest. And I don't see really that we have the military, the junta military, at the point of really breaking down. I don't see that. If you look at the military operations, they can sustain them. They can sustain supply. They have the maintenance capabilities. They have successfully, I would say, as far as I can say that, but it looks to me like that, driven their conscription program. As far as I heard it, many people are not that unhappy to have the chances aligned with being in the military. Job offers after having served, and also the money paid to them is attractive, I think. So it doesn't look like the military is really getting to the point of weakness that it breaks down. I don't see that. There have been these hopes after the big successes, but I think in the long run it doesn't look like that. And then you also have the external factors. You have the Chinese factor. You could see how they could scale up or scale down the posture of different forces, of different parties in the conflict on both sides. Therefore, I'm quite skeptical in military point of view. And talking about the other side, unity, yeah. But again, if you want to forge a constitution, what you basically do is you craft a social contract. Not everyone has to agree. It is to a certain extent a fiction. It is hegemonic. But in the end of the day, there have to be enough forces to support a given social contract or a constitution formed on the basis of such a social contract than the forces opposing that. And I don't simply see that. And the documents we have right now, they are very vague. They are not legal in nature, I would say. They are more political pamphlets, political declarations, but they would not carry really a constitution drafting project. What is okay, I mean, there could be talks in the future, but as I said, I don't see the political basis for crafting a new social contract.
To give another pushback, another devil's advocate from the argument that you gave, the latter part of what you said, that the agreements that are being fleshed out between the resistant actors, they've not developed to a point that gives you confidence in where that could be going down into the future. Some of the interviews that we've done on this podcast and from Myanmar actors, what I've heard as a response to that has been in the form of local public governance, of saying that why wait for these top-down solutions to come that have been going back to previous iterations of the peace process that are always problematic and troublesome in one way. Let's work on actually doing things right now on the ground. And there have been many examples of imperfect in extremely trying and challenging conditions that I don't know how much any of us in our societies, if we were in those places, if we'd be doing much better, but imperfect yet also very diligent and in some ways inspiring attempts that are showing results from local public governance, which is taking place already right now. And so a flip side to this argument, and again, a devil's advocate view to this argument, is that, well, maybe the future isn't figuring everything else up top down and everything coming in line. Maybe it's this experiment of local public governance, which is already happening now, starting to blossom and starting to grow, and then that's starting to lead and rise up to the top.
Again, I am not really in the position to judge on anything here. It's just my impression. But I would say a country like Myanmar, with that history, now at the point that basically all ethnical groups are claiming their stake in the process, also to an unprecedented degree. Everyone wants to somehow shape the end result. And in such a historical process, I think it would not be enough to create islands of good local governance. What is possible, what also might happen, and it might happen in different directions, though. If you see, for example, there are some groups or there are some territories that are governed quite stable, but not necessarily on the basis of the rule of law, human rights or democracy. But there are some of these quite stable local strongholds. And that is already pointing to the problem. How can you develop a constitution for the entire country if you have really very diverse strongholds that are functioning? So even if this is possible, to create out of that a constitutional platform for the entire country, which is based on, let's say, on federal ideas, on human rights guarantees, on the rule of law, democracy, is very difficult, quite difficult. And I think if you look at Iraq, for example, we could see there were some of the regions were successful, like Kurdistan. But in the end of the day, it didn't become the nucleus of overall constructive constitution nation-building process. And I would remain skeptical. Sorry to say that.
Sure. So then if your view is that the military is not as vulnerable as being able to collapse any day now, and if the resistance is not as unified in being able to either A, defeat the military, or B, to if there was some control or defeat, to be able to find a way to a common vision to come together, if there's those two realities combined with a third reality I would insert, which is the resoluteness and resilience and dedication of so many Burmese that are in the resistance, that are not looking to give up anytime soon, and have, from the interviews we've done, have an extraordinary will to keep on going and sacrifice with whatever it is. If that is the reality we're looking at, then what comes next, and or what are possibilities of what we might be seeing in the next several years, in your opinion?
Yeah, first of all, it surely saddens me to see that, because I made the experience of engaging with many of these people from Myanmar, and I was really impressed by their stance and their morale and the efforts many of these people are taking. And now, looking in the future, it depends very much also on the external factors. I mean, many factors are playing into each other. One is externally, all the powers that are having their stakes. Do they change their involvement? I'm talking about China. I'm talking about India, the West as well. There are a lot of possible changes. We also have countries more distant, but yet very important, Russia, Belarus, So difficult to say. Thailand, Bangladesh, also important stakeholders, they all have some leverage over the process. And then internally, the question is, how stable is the regime? There have been rumors, I heard rumors, and incredible rumors, that there were, for certain moments at least, that there was a real threat to the leadership. So we don't know about that. If there would be a change in the leadership structure on side of the junta, I wouldn't say that this is really necessarily changing the course of things, but could happen. And then it looks more like, irrespective of these two factors, so the internal political factor on side of the junta and the geopolitical factor, beside that, I would assume that we will have more of these non-inclusive ceasefires, which we had already. And I think they created a, if you want, dangerous model of trading territory. There you have also, again, China involved in this. Maybe India will be involved, who knows, in supporting that. And that is also reflecting the support for the elections for the 28th of December of probably, likely, these two countries. So that is what I would expect, that we have a stalemate that is not going to anything new. Maybe we will have more of these non-inclusive ceasefires. Maybe that is creating even conflict between ethnical armed organizations, also possible. So to reclaim territory, which was taken by another group to trade it then.
Yeah.
So that's what I would expect more.
Right. So to synthesize what you said, is that some version of like a protracted stalemate with various theaters of conflict that are shifting and land being traded with foreign influence coming in some form or the other? Is that a, would that be a right way to say it?
Yeah, kind of stable, instable situation, to take this term. Yeah, that is what I would expect. And then you can have a lot of movement, a lot of volatility, dynamics in the situation, but it will not lead to anything decisive.
Well, you then, in that kind of lawless state, you also have a real, we've already seen this, I mean, a great illicit activities taking off, and everything from scam centers to natural resources, and then the type of foreign engagement that we're seeing, you know, obviously that will be very self-serving in terms of those foreign countries coming in and taking what they want of Myanmar for their own benefit.
Yes, exactly. And I think this is another thing. We have quite fuzzy geopolitics here in the Myanmar case. Everyone is doing something, but very restrained, very discreet. And at the same time, we have this large lawless base that is entrenching. Organized crime in all kinds and all forms is spreading. And that is very conducive to this overall situation, because for sure, the level of statehood is extremely low. The level of living standard is very, very low. But if you have this involvement of organized crime and an organized economy, organized criminal economy, then you can sustain that for a very, very long time. And that is also why I think rather a long stalemate.
Mm-hmm. But looking at that criminal economy and asking the question, who does that benefit? Well, certainly it benefits the criminals that are making upwards of billions of dollars engaging in it. It might benefit the different armed actors that are also are able to support themselves and their conflict through it. I can't imagine that many of the neighbors would like that criminal economy very much, though.
Yeah, sure. It's destabilizing the country where we are right now, Thailand, in many ways. We have a drug problem scaling up. We have the arms trade growing in the region. And for sure, the number one topic in Thailand and in other countries is human trafficking. And this reached indeed massive proportions. And many people are not happy. I talk with people in Bangladesh. They are very, very concerned. People, I think in most countries in the region are very concerned, but they don't know what to do, and they don't have that much leverage to do anything constructive, but a lot of not very constructive things. That's a problem. And then you have powers like Indonesia, who feel solidarity with the Muslim part of the affected population, so trying to play a more constructive, more viable role in the ASEAN framework to have some influence on the conflict, but that is simply too far away from the conflict. And so I don't see any actor who has now the goodwill and the means to be of any help for a real solution.
So then if we just take a moment and look at those four neighboring actors, which you mentioned, Thailand, Bangladesh, China, and India, and just go through them. We start with Thailand to expand on it. You mentioned how there's enormous concern right now in Thailand with the influx of drugs as well as human trafficking that's coming through here. What are other Thai concerns? Well, on the one hand, Thai concerns, and on the other hand, Thai points of leverage or exploitation or things that they're hoping to get out of Myanmar, influence it in a way that benefits them?
First of all, you have in Thailand different power groups, different power centers, and they have a different agenda with Myanmar, and that's one point. Then you have the fact that we are living in a geopolitical age. So geopolitics were always there, but right now, I would say, on a global level, geopolitics are a primary choice of political leaders. And Thailand is no exception to that. So I see that there is a beginning awareness of the geopolitical factor here in this relation. So that is another thing to be observed. I don't know where that goes. I don't know how strong that is. But there are some considerations about the geopolitical interest of Thailand in Southeast Asia vis-a-vis Myanmar, wherever that leads to. And you can see the relevance of this geopolitical factor when you look at the border conflict between Thailand and Cambodia, which is difficult to explain. And the only reason I see for this upsurging conflict is that we are living in a geopolitical time where leaders are really tempted to take a geopolitical card and play that. So that's one thing. And then in Thailand, you have very very opposing interests. You have a certain interest in the workforce for Myanmar, while at the same time the Thai population is facing difficult economic circumstances, and that is creating a certain resentment against migrants from Myanmar. That is an issue. And on a certain wave of nationalism in Thailand, you might see also that sentiments are developing maybe in a more forceful direction here. So it's complicated in Thailand.
Just to pause a moment before we go on to the other neighbors, I'm really interested in the comment you made about the geopolitical outlook that many countries have today. And it mirrors a conversation that I had recently at Fortify Rights with Patrick Pungsathorn, where he was referencing how the world that he entered as a human rights defender has changed dramatically in these decades, in the sense that of the night, you know, entering it during the 90s in his case, a time where there was the rule of law and a belief in international order and international systems were so strong, and the focus was there for that. And now so much of the work that he does and people like him rests on the international order actually, the these rules actually doing and saying what they say they do, and the fact that there have been, in so many cases around the world, there have been extreme violations of these rules, and they've been done with impunity, and there's been very little consequence or pushback for them. I think this fits into what you're saying, that that this is bringing this greater geopolitical outlook among many countries, which is how you may explain the Thailand-Cambodia skirmish. And so in that case, just taking a step back and looking at if this is a new kind of global order or outlook or culture that we're entering into, and this, you know, Myanmar just seems like it just has heaps of bad luck upon bad luck with what it goes through. If Myanmar is going through what it's going through at a time of a changing geopolitical order, what does that mean?
Yeah, exactly. That is very much how I see it. If you try to understand what geopolitics means, it's a form of reason of state politics or realpolitik in foreign affairs. But it is those form of power politics in foreign affairs that is projecting power and influence beyond the own borders. So I project power into space. That is geopolitics about. And we are living right now, I think empirically you can prove it, in a time of geopolitics. Geopolitics have been a constant of foreign policy since thousands of years. But right now we have an upsurge of this choice, of the geopolitical choice. And if you think about what geopolitics is, to project power beyond the own borders into strategic spaces, then it is inevitable that geopolitics or primary focus on geopolitics is creating tension and border conflicts and wars. And we see that everywhere. We see it in Africa, in Latin America. We see it in Europe. The invasion of Russia in Ukraine is a geopolitical conflict par excellence. But we see it also in Asia everywhere, between Pakistan and India. We have a geopolitical weakening of the domestic politics in Bangladesh through the conflict in Myanmar. So in Thailand right now, to come back to Thailand, you could see that a prime minister was axed over, in the last instance, geopolitical questions, because she had a phone talk, Thai prime minister had a phone talk with the father of the Cambodian prime minister, and that was seen as illoyal to the own country in a geopolitical tensioned situation. So that is a broader context where I also see the conflict in Myanmar, or the civil war in Myanmar. And the question is if the rather fuzzy geopolitics concerning external actors will change, and we will see more direct engagements or scaled up engagements of other geopolitical players, most likely in terms of arms deliveries, anti-tank weapons, ground-to-air missiles. That would be a total game changer for sure. I don't see that coming now, but who knows? Depends very much on the larger geopolitical equilibrium, how that develops between the United States and China, but also between the United States and India on the one hand, and India and China on the other hand. All that will have an influence on how this geopolitical factor is kicking in the future.
Right. So then moving to the next neighboring country, China, an immensely important player. And certainly right off the bat, we know that China cares about its investments, about BRI, about natural resources, and some have even gone so far as to say that the Chinese influence that it's showing over Myanmar is almost to become a kind of sub-state or vassal state that it's controlling. But there have been differing views of exactly what China is doing. I think it's not quite as clear as other countries in terms of how to make it out, what exactly their game has been and what it's been over these years and what it is now.
Totally important for both sides. From the Chinese perspective, it's for sure decisive how this conflict is ending. Although I think they are perceiving this conflict as non-ending for the foreseeable future, but it is for sure a vital question for China, who controls Myanmar, in geopolitical terms again, because of the link between the Andaman Sea and Yunnan. So that is decisive. At the same time, China plays different parties in this conflict. Sure, on the one hand, the government, the junta is clearly supported by China in many ways, but also by Russia, which is also important. I think recently, but we might come to Russia, staying with China. I think it is nevertheless very significant how China is playing really two opposing forces at the same time. And we could see that. And that is also leading to this trend of trading territories. The Chinese did that. The Chinese are also interested in their buffer zone, and to retain their buffer zone, they scaled up and scaled down the involved players on both sides. And so that's very decisive. And I think that is not the last time that we saw that. And there are different groups that are very, that are closely connected to Chinese stakeholders.
On the other hand, I think it's also a true statement to pose, to what degree does China have confidence in the military regime actually taking and holding power as being a servant to their aims? And then on the other hand, looking at the military regime in Minnan Lang, to what degree do they really want to be in the hands and the puppets of China?
I think the junta has not many choices, so not up to them. And from the Chinese perspective, I would say, I don't know, but ruling by what happened already and what would be rational, I would say this is not a situation where you have to prove to be loyal to anyone from a Chinese perspective. You will do whatever is necessary to have relatively the best position in the country, meaning that no force is taking over that is against China or opening spaces for anti-Chinese forces. And at the same time, making sure that the buffer at the border to Yunnan is safe. So China will decide case by case what is good right now, and can do so because we have this instable situation, which will probably last for quite some time, and which will see always different forces rising or declining, rising again, declining again. And in such a scenario, you can play that way.
And you think China is in a real prime position to hold those strings and to be able to adjust, not obviously it's like a game board that they're in complete control of all the characters, but that their influence on that game board is profound.
Yeah, different regarding different ethnical armed organizations, but some of them are since a long, long time closely connected to Chinese actors and to the Chinese state. And with that conflict going on and going on, I think this is deepening and entrenching. And at the same time, China seems to me having changed a little bit its stance. In the beginning, it was more like really simply supporting the junta. And then it turned out this is not the best strategy, so they play now two sides if necessary. But behind that is also a change in general in the Chinese approach towards, I would say, more rationalization. You can also see that if you look at the Belt and Road Initiative. The Belt and Road Initiative is less, how can I say, ruthlessly realized now. So China is very interested in having good governance everywhere where it's implementing Belt and Road projects, and also contributing to good governance, and also providing even good governance. And therefore, there is a very careful approach now to not be too closely aligned with someone who is the loser in the end, and who will and who is blamed by the global public. And that is another factor, I think, why they're really playing case by case and trying to see what opportunities are opening up.
And then moving on to Bangladesh, obviously the glaring issue there are the Rohingya camps, much more in that border situation and of those relations. What would you share about Bangladesh?
Yeah, a disaster. It's a disastrous situation in Bangladesh. Bangladesh is struggling very much right now, since some time. And there's a strong sentiment against the refugees. There are heavy-handed campaigns in these camps against organized crime, which is also, yeah, the organized crime in the camps is affecting not only the security of Bangladesh, but it's also affecting the human rights of the people in the camps, which are anyway quite exposed. So it's a complicated thing, and now we have the new government in Bangladesh will probably try to show more solidarity with Muslim populations. That is important right now for the government, and also for the next government, very likely. But nevertheless, it's a volatile situation. Bangladesh is really burdened with the situation, is repeatedly asking the international community for more engagement, for more help, and not receiving that. And from a certain moment on, it might also get to, let's say, destructive course of events, where the government is simply doing things that are, in the end, radicalizing the populations in the camps and not improving the security situation. Could be.
Of these four actors, of these four neighbors, Bangladesh is the one we hear the least about. The other three take up so much oxygen in the room, but and when we do hear about Bangladesh, we often hear about the exodus of the Rohingya people, the state of the camps, Cox's Bazar, and the terrible atrocities and genocide that happened there, which deservedly so take up a lot of room and attention because it was such a horrible and monumental phenomenon that happened and that's still continuing. But it is, Bangladesh is a neighbor, and as with the other neighbors, there is ways that they can engage. You mentioned that there is a priority to want to show sympathy towards Myanmar's Muslim population. But as far as engagement goes, when it comes to these other four neighbors, are there things that Bangladesh that you know of that they're actually doing, or that they could be doing, or they're looking to maybe start to proceed that will then start to that could have a real effect on Myanmar's conflict as these other three neighbors are doing?
I can't say much. I met people from the former government. I used to advise that government on behalf of the European Union in a law reform project, and I talked in that vein with quite some people there, also from the security apparatus. And at that time, I could sense that there's a great concern about the situation. Right now, we have an interim government. Mohamed Yunus is not entitled to long-lasting political decisions for the country. So we have to wait for the new regular government coming in to see how things will turn out. But for sure, this will be a government that is, let's say, more sympathetic to political Islam. That is almost for sure. And that has implications like the solidarity of the overwhelmingly Muslim Indonesian state for the Rohingya. So this kind of solidarity will be a factor, but maybe the situation is that bad when this government is taking over in Bangladesh in these Rohingya camps, also for the Bangladesh side, that they that will not play any role. I don't know. Honestly, I have no idea how it will go with Bangladesh. I just know the country is heavily affected, and it is also perceived as a really critical factor for domestic stability, domestic safety in Bangladesh.
Just to pose a more wider question, as we're in the kind of theorizing stage of involvement and looking at, you mentioned how Bangladesh and Indonesia have concern for the Muslim population. Of course, Muslims in Palestine, this has been in the Middle East, and really Muslims all around the world, this has brought attention to their plight and the concern for their rights into direct engagement in that issue. It seems like the plight of Muslims in Myanmar and the persecution they've been under, it hasn't brought that same level of scrutiny and action and real involvement.
Yeah, it's definitely noticed. I know it from European Muslim communities. Sure, they share social media posts, and they share evidence of atrocities. And no, it's not totally ignored or neglected. It's aware. There is a certain awareness also in Europe. In the Muslim diaspora in Europe, there's a clear awareness of what's going on in Myanmar or with the Rohingya. Yeah. And Turkey is, I think Turkey is feeling if you want to say that, responsible. Turkey is was the seat of the last Khalif, I think until 1924. So, and Erdogan is trying to align with that tradition and to have this role of guardian of Muslim globally. So Turkey is itself very weak economically, but having an impressive geopolitical posture given that weakness, and that also includes a certain interest in the situation in Myanmar / Bangladesh by Turkey. Yeah.
Interesting. And so then the last neighbor we have to look at is India, and India is largely concerned with security on the border. And we know that there's been support between New Delhi and NAPIDA and in a number of ways. But what more can you tell us about Indian relations?
Again, not much I know, but the seven stars, seven states close to Myanmar have always been a problem. They had their own insurgencies in these seven stars, and they are overlapping ethnicities at the Indian-Myanmar border. As far as I know, India is observing the situation way more carefully than it might appear, given its actions. So they are really looking at that. Until now, I don't see much engagement, but that could change. And that again will be very dependent on the relation with China. So if we have a rapprochement with, between China and India, that would be a more careful and more coordinated engagement, and also lead very likely to a supportive stance of the elections in December together with China. If the situation is developing in the opposite direction, there could be unilateral harder engagement if the situation overall is worsening from an Indian perspective. What is also including domestic concerns in the seven states. So difficult to say, but I think that is roughly the frame.
You mentioned before this interview the fear in India of a wider Mizo rebellion kicking off that would, of course, impact all of this.
Yeah, you have this potential in on the Indian side of the border. You have the potential for insurgency. You have also low-level insurgencies. And this is for sure a very important issue for Indian national security. And there have been also some issues also with Bangladesh at the border in the last 2 years. So I think there's a lot of attention given to this conflict. Yeah.
And just to round out some of these players, you as you were talking about China, you went to Russia. Before, you had mentioned Russia and Belarus together. These, from the very earliest days of the coup, these were definitely two very close friends of the military, and Russia certainly has been through without. What is your sense of why Russia has zeroed in on this and has chosen to be so steadfast in siding with the Myanmar military in very public ways?
Naja, not much to lose, first of all. That's one thing. Now you can deal with anyone. We could see that. That's no problem. And then you have long-established relations, like with other important middle powers in the region, like Vietnam. So these relations have been there before the conflict erupted. And I don't know how meaningful the influence of Russian support is right now. But overall, the build-up of the Burmese military is highly shaped by that Russian influence. And the weapon systems, even the old weapon systems, seem to be quite okay. They seem to prove quite useful. More recently, I think Russia is focusing on its own problems in Ukraine, but there have been, and I can't assess how valuable that is, but there have been these attempts to upgrade military doctrine in Myanmar, that's, I think, going on right now. So you have right now Russian-trained military officers trying to implement an upgrade of military doctrine based on what they have learned from the Russians. And if this is good for them or not too good for them, I can't say. But probably better to have some doctrine if compared to have not much doctrine. And I think that that is the situation. But just my assessment.
Mm-hmm, right. And I think in those early days of the relationship, there was I saw it characterized as these are kind of rebels of the global order. They're kind of outcasts or misfits that by coming together, they create their own alliance and nodes. And I think, you know, nowhere has that been seen more incredibly than this recent conference in China with Western leaders locked out of it and Minhan Lang there, many others there, and just seeing those images of this rogues gallery of a different kind of axis. You know, I think this is something, this conference, I mean, this front of New York Times, front, you know, center of many conversations. Outside of Myanmar reportage, I didn't see any reference to Myanmar's military leader being there. There's a lot that we can say about this conference itself, but in the context of that conference, what do you see as the importance of Minhan Lang being a member?
Yeah, I mean, what you describe is, I think, a very profound development in global affairs or we could describe it as a kind of de-Westernization of global affairs. And that is how many countries in the global south see it and support it. And not only the rock states. There are a lot of governments, but also populations that are not unhappy with a shift towards the global south and away from the west. And one manifestation of this process is that we don't have anymore these outcasts in the international system. We have the West and a waning influence of the West. And then we have a consolidating global South where relations to countries like Iran, North Korea, Russia are no problem at all. Not at all. If you look at Africa, how governments are reorienting their foreign policy, you can see that very clearly. But basically, I think you can see that in the entire global south. And that is also good for the junta in Myanmar. And it is not that easy for Western powers to field diplomatic support against them. Because more and more countries will simply refrain from siding against the junta. And that will be one of the effects of what you described, this larger process of what is perceived in the global south, de-Westernization, which is quite welcomed in many parts of the global south.
And to me, one of the things that I felt when I was watching this, at least as it pertains to Myanmar, was this question of legitimization. And Minhan Lang being there, this was a great moment of legitimization towards his rule and being in Myanmar. And the question came to me as I was seeing this, well, you could certainly look at all of those spheres of the world who were not invited or did not attend this gathering, but it's kind of glass half full, glass half empty way. But you could also look at it at all of those who were there and this sense that how isolated could this military and this figure be if he is invited as a representative at this event with all of these other leaders that, well, okay, he's part of something now. That's undeniable. Right.
Sure, that is lending more and more legitimacy to the junta in Myanmar. Yeah.
Right. So then the last player to look at in this is you talk about the de-Westernization, and so one can't but bring America, the United States, into this. And, you know, I think it was to no one's surprise, although it would have come as a complete shock any number of years before this administration, that far from being angered that this conference took place, Donald Trump's biggest fury seemed to be that he was not invited and he did not attend. The United States has not only withdrawn from any number of treaties, from promoting democracy, fair elections, human rights, obviously the shutdown of international aid, a complete walking back of everything else. So on one sense, there's this great negligence and this great vacuum they're leaving of the priorities they were funding before. But then, that's one part of it. The other part of that equation is rather looking at the United States not just as not doing what we might like to think of the right thing, doing nothing at all, but then there's the other side of it of could they actually engage in the wrong or harmful way. And when I had a recent podcast with former U.S. Ambassador Derek Mitchell, and we were talking about this, we came to a thought that in some ways it's almost a quite, when we look at potential ways that the U.S. could engage in Myanmar, whether we're looking at rare earths, whether we're looking at buffering the influence of China, whether we're looking at just another strongman that he wants to admire or get with, it becomes a question of if we no longer have hope that there could be any positive engagement from the United States, the question then becomes of maybe perhaps you're left with two bad options, either complete negligence or engaging in the wrong side.
Oh, frightening. I hope, I can't imagine anything like that. I can't imagine that Washington will side with the junta, or will send out signals that are positive for the junta. Difficult to imagine that. I think that is far away. In other conflicts, maybe also total turnarounds, but not here. I hope and I believe that will not happen.
I hope so as well. But you know, Russia was once. The Dark Emperor, and right. You know, now is that was a change. Of course, Trump has a special relationship with Russia, and so I think it's anyone's guess what would happen next. But that does bring up this question of elections, because Rubio did send a memo saying that the embassies will no longer comment on the freedom of elections. So in the context of Myanmar's upcoming elections and all of the work that America has done historically in looking, you know, Carter Center and so many other places looking at the importance of fair elections, what let's bring this concept of elections into it, and especially as America's engaged.
There is a lot lost talking about constructive American engagement. There was a lot of positive engagement, and that is scaled back dramatically. But a deliberate siding with this regime, I can't imagine it. And be it only because I can't see anybody for Donald Trump in this group of strongmen. No one fits the profile he's looking for, I think. I can't imagine that at all. I can imagine it with Putin, I can imagine it with Kim, but not with anyone in Myanmar. Impossible for me to imagine
sure.
that.
Sure. But looking at these elections, we know they're not going to be fair. We know what the outcome is going to be. What does it mean that the United States has said that they know that embassies are no longer allowed to comment on elections being free and fair? What does this mean, particularly for Myanmar's upcoming election?
Particular in this case, I think it is detrimental, but limited though, because it's clear that these elections are not fair and free, and by all means not inclusive. So it doesn't matter that much. Symbolically, yes, but there will be enough Western powers who will be very clear about that, and there's no doubt about that. And I think everyone who has common sense and looks at the process will come to the same conclusion. As a sideshow of the elections, you will have for sure, and you already have way more repression and persecution. That is definitely in effect. And in that regard, I totally understand the fear. But in the end, what will be achieved by these elections is just a very thin layer of so-called legitimacy, which will anyway not turn anyone who was formerly skeptical towards this government in favor of the government, or the other way around. So it will not change that much. It will just produce another version of that regime. We will have a clear setup then, who is who is in charge. That's it. Not much more. So I don't see any greater outcome of these elections.
Taking a moment to just look at how we got here, and that was the previous elections held at, we could say, the end of the imperfect transition period. You and many other analysts out there were very critical of this transition period. I believed you called it a democratic facade with a military heart, and you were critical of the 25% representation that the military had, saying this was almost unprecedented in the whole world. You were critical of rule of law and the judiciary, that referencing that going back since, I think it was 1974, that there have been very few judges that have not been military aligned. Indeed, some of the military aligned judges have absolutely no experience of what the law is or of sitting on the bench. Very interestingly, the interpretations and analysis of Aung San Suu Kyi never end. Everyone has their own little special view of trying to figure out this enigmatic figure. And I appreciated the view you brought to it as being that you interpreted, if I get this right, that when she started to realize that she couldn't reform the military and there wasn't a place to bring in democratic processes to the power of the military, she instead reformed to them. And trying to maybe keep along some of those softer democratic underpinnings, but to a large degree, she realized that she had to fit in their system rather than having them fit in theirs. I think I think the devil's advocate argument would be that this was for a period of time, and she was hoping to develop those later, but we will never know that. And looking at the civil-military relations, you called that a Praetorianism, the relationship between the civil and military factors, a technical word that I think I might have to have you unpack for our audience. But to just set this all up, because this didn't come from nowhere, obviously, and this criticism, I wonder if you could unpack some of this criticism you had of the transition period, and then talk about how that background led to and fed into everything that we're seeing today.
Naja, it is difficult to judge on someone like the lady who did a lot for her country, but who also plays an ambiguous role for me, at least in my impression. Maybe to the Praetorian factor here. The Praetorian Guard was a Roman elite guard protecting the consul or the emperor later, and later became in the empire the kingmaker. So it was a special military unit, if you want, creating the emperor, sometimes killing an emperor, sometimes even fielding an empire out of their own ranks. And this specific factor of military involvement in politics in Myanmar after the transition can be described by this term. And I think what you pointed out very importantly is the vacuum of any constitutional discourse, or in terms of any constitutional discourse in the old system, and also any constitutional infrastructure. Judges, courts, literature, doctrine, universities producing sufficiently educated constitutional lawyers, all that was lacking. And therefore, and there I'm very, very hopeful, I totally admire all the young people or middle-aged people and older people in the diaspora who put incredible efforts to keep up and to gain legal knowledge, to draft laws, to understand how to translate policies into law, how to interpret laws. That is remarkable. And there I see something I can't find any example for that anywhere else.
Yeah, great.
That a population in exile has such a strong... how can you call it, mission to prepare themselves to fill this vacuum. That is something very, very positive and something where I, again and again, I'm surprised, because I didn't see that in other in other movements to that extent. And that is really the good side of what I see right now, what's going on right now, that there's at least a lot of preparation and very sincere preparation to fill that gap of as I call it, constitutional infrastructure in the country. Because you had a similar development in Cambodia. After the Paris Accords and after the restart of the Cambodian state project, if you want to call it like that, in the 1990s, there was nothing, totally nothing. And I think there was not enough effort in that time to rebuild. And in the case of Myanmar, this is one of the very positive factors we see.
Yeah. And this is also quite different forces at play again, the strength of this diaspora, of this Gen Z, of this this resilience and diligence to want to seek a better future versus the breakdown in geopolitical order, the influence of the neighbors, the some of the warring factions. And so this is, again, these things are at loggerheads. Yeah. So I want to return to this concept of this reality of the ethnic voices, and because you can't talk about Myanmar without talking about these ethnic factions. And you began the conversation by looking into these ethnic factions and saying that there's just too much daylight between them, that the visions of who they are and what they want are too far apart, despite the solidarity that's coming. And so I guess the question I have is, what does that mean? You know, as we move along and as we look at the shape this conflict takes, and it's impossible to talk about each and every one of them. And even as you talk about each and every one of them, you get further splintered. I mean, there's not just one KNU, for example. There are different KNU factions, and you could, I mean, what is Myanmar, if anything, but a splintering everywhere? And, you know, Rakhine, what an absolute complex mess that very few people understand. And being unable to look at every single one individually and understand where they come together, just in a general sense, the disparity between the perspectives and missions of these different ethnic organizations, and some of them being aligned strongly this way or that way, and some just kind of going which way the wind blows. How can we understand this factor?
It's difficult to say. You have totally differently aligned forces here. You have forces that have nothing in common with visions of democratic good governance, as we understand it in the West, that have a totally different approach towards human rights, if at all any approach, or the rule of law. So these groups exist, and they are, some of them, I don't want to call names here, but some of them are the military more potent one, the more capable ones, that are unluckily not that much aligned with Western constitutional values. And then you have other groups that might be, or that are, more prone to that. But they have, for sure, their particular interests, and they want to survive. And they also distrust the NUG, to say that frankly. And they don't expect that much from the NUG if the day X is coming. So this is really, and I don't want to blame here the NUG, but I just described the situation as I see it from talks I have. And in this situation, how can you imagine that all the different voices, all the different forces come together and agree on a viable constitutional document? Very difficult. It would be imaginable if there would be a unifying force. And I think that, to a certain extent, also explains the behavior of the lady. So maybe you have to play out a more authoritarian card sometimes from the perspective of the one who wants to unite, maybe. And maybe she tried that to a certain degree, maybe justified or not, I don't know. But that is, I think, what was possible back then, but that is not anymore any option, because there is no unifying leader. And the other opportunity would be that an external force that is strong enough is making sure that a certain consensus is reached and stabilized. But also there we have no one. It can't be America, which would have played that role in the past, maybe not for Myanmar, but generally speaking, America is not in the position and not willing probably to do that right now, vis-a-vis a very powerful China, and China will also not play that role. India can't play that role, not because of its power posture, but because of its like China, of its own stakes in the game. So who could do that? ASEAN can't do that. ASEAN is not able to do that as well. And that is why I think it will be very difficult to really unite all parties, even on a very modest platform. And that is what you need. If you write a constitution, you have to agree on certain core directions you want to take. Do you want to have the rule of law, democracy and human rights as a core of your constitution or not? Or do you want to have maybe more state sovereignty as a primary value? But if you want to have that in this context, you would exert that sovereignty with a certain authoritarian power and influence, which will definitely not be the choice of anyone of the ethnical armed organizations. No one will agree to that someone else has that power. So I think hard to imagine. I don't know how that could turn out. And at the same time, you have attempts to already create constitutional realities on the ground in the Shan state. So people already try to do that in their own territory. And the more they live with that, and the more you have these solutions taking root, the more difficult it will be to then agree on something else and to do a compromise. So therefore, not easy at all. Probably the most difficult internal conflict to bring to such a solution in the world. I can't see anything else. Any other conflict where you have such a pessimistic outlook for a viable solution that can be sustained.
Those are quite bold words. That it's one of it's the most complex conflict waging in the world today. That has been waging for going on, it seems like, 80 years now. That there's no other present example that is this complex. I want to prompt you, looking from history, do you see any precedent from history of something that previously was as complex as what we're dealing with now, where we may have lessons learned from it?
Only if you have a unifying factor, and you don't have that. So it's in a certain form of anarchy, an asymmetrical anarchy with stronger and weaker players, but it's an anarchy. And you don't have any unifying force, and there is no unifying force visible in the future, neither externally nor internally.
So that's where you see these zones of conflict, as you've put it, where these conflicts are waging. China is playing a bit of puppet strings in terms of where they're able to tamp down or tamp up or trade territory. You have the natural resources flowing. You have the neighbors and the outside players running influence as they like. You have the natural resource extraction and the illicit activities, that horrible, awful scam centers, human trafficking, narcotics, taking off in lawless regions. And so, yes, to start the conversation off, the pessimism that you see, this is certainly a pessimistic state described.
Yeah, most likely. I mean, you never know. The junta could collapse. I don't see it, but what do I know? I mean, could happen. And if you have such a collapse, that might motivate all the other players to find a common ground. I just don't see it that likely. But who knows? Maybe a miracle is happening. Possible. But not likely.
Right. The last question I have, I'd like to go in a slightly different direction, but one that I know is of great interest to me. And we talked about before we started recording, is something that you're also interested in. And to prompt you to talk about this interaction between Buddhism and Buddhist thought, as we see in Myanmar governance versus Thai governance. You had some thoughts on that I'd like to invite you to share.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And how far cultural pattern are influencing political processes. And in Thailand, Buddhism plays a very distinct role for the concepts of power, of governance, of law. It is shaping political realities, but in a totally indirect way. So Buddhism is not an active political force. As such, it is taken out basically of the political discourse. Totally important in shaping concepts and in shaping attitudes, but not something that is interfering in any way. And in Myanmar, I think Buddhism is, it's both. You have the state-controlled Buddhism, but also the state-controlling Buddhism to a certain degree. So any leader has to show Buddhist credentials. But you also have a kind of independent kind of Buddhist discourse, which is quite ambiguous, which can be hyper-nationalistic and also supportive of quite ugly developments. And then you have the other other streamline in this. So I think it is maybe also more diverse than in Thailand, as far as I can see. And I would like to study about that, but I don't know anything about it. But I think it's a fascinating topic. And also, what really interests me is the possibility to reconcile Buddhist-informed politics with violence. That is an interesting issue. And not in the primitive sense, but or as a kind of a rhetorical trick, but in a really conceptual way. Because at the first glance, Buddhism is non-violent, and Buddhist governance is a non-interfering, non-violent form of governance. But there are some residual spaces in the Buddhist political theology that would allow the exceptional use of violence, especially where you have Buddhist conceptions of politics or political realities that are informed by Hindu traditions. There again, especially by the Shiva factor, what we had in Cambodia, where we had a kind of very short Buddhist kingship, heavily influenced by Hinduistic thought. And that was then replicated in Thailand, in Indonesia, in some other Buddhist kingdoms, and there might be some residual spaces for political violence within a Buddhist conception of governance. But it's a large topic, and would be very interesting to dive deeper into that. Maybe just to say again, I don't want to sound like someone who knows anything. I just have my observations. And I have the utmost respect for everyone who tries to improve the situation on the side of the Myanmar population for their people, for their country. And that is what I constantly experience here, because there are so many Burmese people in Thailand, and I really find that remarkable. And I hope the best, and I hope I didn't offend anyone with a skeptical view on the things.
No, I really appreciate your honest analysis. I think that I'm a big believer in the fact that if we, whether it's we're talking about an individual or a society or organization or anything else, we have to be quite honest with identifying the problems and the challenges if we're going to do anything to work with them. And so I think that the more that we're able to check in with different views and have those honest conversations from informed actors, I think that we all benefit.
No, I just want to thank you that you allow me to be on that podcast with 400 issues already. That's great. And so thank you very much that you counted me in.
In a world where Myanmar's crisis has largely faded from the headlines, critical voices and perspectives are often left unheard. And that's where we hope to come in. Through this humble platform, we're trying to provide something unique, an opportunity to share important experiences, insights, struggles, and perspectives in depth and in a way that few other media sources offer. Our content not only keeps the sputtering global conversation about Myanmar alive, but it also brings much-needed attention to those now fighting for their freedom and dignity. So if you value this work and the perspectives we're offering, please consider supporting us. Your contributions help us to continue to amplify those voices and provide the world with the coverage Myanmar so desperately deserves. Visit insightmyanmar.org/donation to stand with us.
Oh, ba, yara nanda, yara nanga, 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 yara nanga